Belden grinned and clapped a gnarled hand on the smith's shoulder.
"You made a good choice, Paul," he chortled. "This is a rare fellow here."
"Yes," she murmured. "I saw that almost immediately." They rode back along the beach to the abandoned fishing village. "Do you want me to do it, Grandfather?" Garion offered. "Set fire to the driftwood, I mean."
"No," the old man replied. "I'll take care of it. You and Paul take the others on down along the shoreline. I'll catch up in a bit."
"Well, do you want these?"
Durnick asked, offering the old man his flint and steel. Belgarath shook his head.
"I'll do it the other way," he said. "I want to give the Candom some noise to listen to as well as the fire to watch. That should get their undivided attention."
He strode off into the fog, heading back up the beach. "Come along, Garion," Polgara said, pushing back the hood of her cloak. "We will scout ahead again. I think we'll want to move fairly fast." The two of them walked a short distance down the beach and made the change once more. "Keep your mind awake as well as your ears and nose," Polgara's voice silently instructed. "With this fog, the Candom will probably be watching with their thoughts rather than their eyes."
"Yes, Aunt Paul," he replied, loping toward the upper end of the beach.
Sand was different underfoot than grass or turf. It gave slightly under his paws, and it slowed him a bit. He decided that he did not really like running in sand. He ran along for a couple of miles without any encounters. Then he heard and felt a shockingly loud surge coming from somewhere behind him. He flinched and glanced back over his shoulder. The fog was illuminated by a sooty orange glow. There was another surge that sounded almost like a detonation, and then another, and another.
"Tacky, Father," he heard Polgara say disapprovingly. "Why are you being so ostentatious?"
"I just wanted to be sure that they heard me, is all," the old man replied.
"They probably heard you in Malzeth. Are you coming back now?"
"Let me start a few more fires first. The Candom have a limited attention span. Besides, the smoke should confuse the hounds' sense of smell."
There were several more detonations.
"That should do it," Belgarus thought had a note of self-satisfaction in it.
About 20 minutes later, the great silver wolf came out of the fog like a ghost.
"Oh, there you are," Belgarus said to Garion, in the way of the wolves. "Let's spread out a bit and move right along. Durnick and the others are right behind us."
"Did the Candom go back to the beach to see what was happening?"
"Oh, yes."
Belgarath's tongue lolled out in the wolf's version of a grin.
"They were definitely curious. There were quite a few of them. Shall we go?"
They ran along for about another hour before Garion's nostrils caught the scent of a horse and rider coming from somewhere ahead. He loped on through the fog, ranging back and forth until he pinpointed the man's location. Then he ran forward. It was a solitary temple guardsman who was galloping northward toward the towering fires Belgarath had ignited. Garion rushed him, snarling terribly. The guardsman's horse squealed in panic, rearing up onto his hind legs and dumping his startled rider into a bleached pile of driftwood. The horse fled, and the guardsman groaned as he lay tangled up in the white logs and branches half buried in the sand.
"Trouble?" Belgarus' thought came out of the fog.
"A guardsman," Garion replied. "He fell off of his horse. I think he may have broken some things."
"Was he alone?"
"Yes, Grandfather. Where are you?"
"Just a ways ahead of you. There are some woods up here. This looks like as good a place as any to turn west. I don't think we need to go all the way down to Gandahar."
"I'll tell Aunt Paul to pass the word to Durnick."
The woods were quite extensive, and there was very little undergrowth. At one point, Garion passed the embers of a campfire, still glowing in the foggy dark. The campsite, however, was deserted, and there were signs that whoever had been there
had departed in some haste. The track of churned loam on the forest floor indicated that the people had galloped off toward the fires on the beach. Geryon ran on. Near the edge of the woods, a faint breeze carried a sharp canine reek. Geryon stopped.
Grandfather,
he sent out his thought urgently.
I smell a dog up ahead.
Only one?
I think so.
He crept forward, his ears and nose alert.
I can only smell one, he reported.
Stay put. I'll be right there.
Geryon dropped to his haunches and waited. A few moments later, the silver wolf joined him.
Is he moving around at all?
Belgoroth asked.
No, Grandfather. He seems to be just sitting in one place. Do you think we can slip around him?
You and I could. But I don't think that Darnik and the others would be able to. The hounds can hear and smell almost as well as wolves can.
Can we frighten him off?
I doubt it. He is bigger than we are. Even if we did, he would just go for help, and we definitely don't want a pack of the hounds on our trail. We are going to have to kill him.
Grandfather,
Geryon gasped. For some reason, the thought of deliberately killing another canine profoundly shocked him.
I know, Belgoroth agreed. The notion is repugnant, but we don't have any choice. He's blocking our way out of this area, and we have to be clear of here by daylight. Now, listen carefully. The hounds are big, but they are not very agile. They particularly aren't very good at turning around in a hurry. I will confront him head-on. You run in behind him and hamstring him. You know how to do that.
That knowledge was instinctive in wolves, and Geryon found, almost with surprise, that he knew precisely what to do.
Yes,
he replied. The speech of wolves is limited in its emotional range, so he could not indicate how uncomfortable this impending encounter made him.
All right, Belgoroth continued. Once you cut his hamstrings, get back out of the range of his teeth. He will try to turn on you. That is instinctive, so he won't be able to stop himself. And that's when I will take his throat.
Geryon shuddered at the deliberateness of the plan. Belgoroth was proposing not a fight, but a cold-blooded killing.
Let's get it over with, Grandfather,
he said unhappily.
Don't whine, Geryon.
Belgoroth's thought came to him. He'll hear you.
I don't like this,
Geryon thought back.
Neither do I. But it is the only thing we can do. Let's go.
They crept among the fog-dimmed tree trunks with the smell of the hound growing stronger in their nostrils. It was not a pleasant smell, since dogs will eat carrion, while wolves will not. Then Geryon saw the hound outlined black against the fog beyond the edge of the trees. Belgoroth paused, indicating that he also saw their intended victim. Then the two wolves separated and moved in the slow, deliberate pace of the hunt, setting each paw carefully and noiselessly down on the damp forest loam. It was over in a shockingly short time. The hound screamed once when Geryon's fangs ripped the tendons of his hind legs, but the scream died into a hideous rattling gurgle as Belgoroth's jaws closed on his throat. The huge black body twitched a few times with its front paws scratching convulsively at the dirt. Then it shuddered and went limp. The dead hound blurred peculiarly, and then there was a Grolem lying on the ground before them, with his throat torn out.
I didn't know they did that,
Geryon said, fighting down a surge of revulsion.
Sometimes they do.
Then Belgoroth sent out his thought.
It's clear now, Paul. Tell Durnik to bring them on through.
As dawn turned the fog opalescent, they took shelter in a ruined village. There had been a wall around it, and part of it was still standing. The houses had been made of stone. Some were still more or less intact, except for the roofs,
Others had been tumbled into the narrow streets. In places, smoke still rose from the shattered debris.
"Well, I think we can risk a fire," Durnick suggested, looking at the smoke.
Polgara looked around.
"A hot breakfast would not hurt," she agreed. "It might be some time before we get another chance for one. Over there, I think. In what's left of that house."
"In just a moment, Durnick," Belgareth said. "I will need you to translate for me."
He looked at Toth.
"I assume you know how to get to Kel from here?" he asked the huge mute.
Toth shifted the unbleached wool blanket he wore draped over one shoulder and nodded.
"In Melsina, we heard that Kel has been sealed off," the old man continued. "Will they let us through?"
Toth made a series of those obscure gestures.
"Oh, he says there won't be any problem, as long as Saradis is still at Kel. She will instruct the other seers to let us through."
"Well, she's there, then?" Belgareth asked.
The gestures came more rapidly.
"I didn't quite follow that," Durnick told his friend.
Toth gestured again, slower this time. Durnick frowned.
"Well, this is a little complicated, Belgareth. As closely as I can make out what he says, she's there and yet not there at the same time. Sort of the way she was when we saw Xandromos that time. But she's also there and not there in several other places as well, and in several different times."
"Well, that's a neat trick," Belden said. "Did he tell you where those other places and times are?"
"No, I think he'd rather not."
"We can respect that," Belgareth said.
"It doesn't diminish the curiosity, though," Belden said.
He brushed a few twigs out of his beard, then pointed at the sky.
"I'm going up there. I think we ought to know how far this fog extends, and what we're likely to run into when we get past it."
He stopped, spread his arms, shimmered, and swooped away. Durnick led the way into the ruined house and built a small fire in the fireplace, while Silk and Sadi prowled through the shattered village. After a short while, they returned with a very thin Melsine in the brown robe of a bureaucrat. "He was hiding in a cellar," Silk reported. The bureaucrat was trembling visibly, and his eyes were wild.
"What is your name?" Belgareth asked him.
The Malsine stared at the old man as if he did not understand.
"I think he's had a bad time lately," Silk said. "We weren't able to get a word out of him."
"Can you give him something to calm his nerves?" Belgareth asked Sadi.
"I was just about to suggest that myself, ancient one."
Sadi went to his red leather case and took out a small glass vial filled with amber liquid. He took a tin cup from the table and poured some water into it. Then he carefully measured a few drops of the amber liquid into the water and swirled it around.
"Why don't you drink this?" he said, handing the trembling Melsine the cup.
The fellow seized the cup gratefully and drained it in several noisy gulps.
"Give it a few moments to take effect," Sadi said quietly to Belgareth.
They watched the terrified man until his trembling subsided.
"Are you feeling any better now, friend?" Sadi asked him.
Yes, the thin fellow replied.
He drew in a long, shuddering breath.
"Thank you. Have you any food? I'm very hungry."
Polgara gave him some bread and cheese.
"This should tide you over until breakfast," she said. "Thank you, lady."
He hungrily took the food and began to wolf it down.
"You look as if you've been through quite a lot lately," Silk said. "None of it pleasant," the bureaucrat told him.
"What did you say your name was?"
"Nebros. I'm with the Bureau of Roads."
"How long have you been in Beldane?"
"It seems like forever, but I suppose it's only been 20 years or so.
What's going on here? The rat-faced man gestured around at the shattered houses.
Absolute chaos, Nabros replied. Things have been in an upheaval for several years now, but last month Zandramas annexed Peldane.
How did she do that? I had heard that she was somewhere in the western part of the continent.
So had I. Maybe she just got word back to her generals. Nobody has seen her for several years now.
Oh, you seem to be fairly well informed, Nabros, Silk suggested. Nabros shrugged.
It goes with being a member of the bureaucracy.
He smiled a bit wanly.
Sometimes I think we spend more time gossiping than we do working.
What have you heard about Zandramas lately?
Belgarath asked.
Well, the fellow replied, rubbing at his unshaven cheek. Just before I fled the bureau offices in Zelda, a friend of mine from the Bureau of Commerce came by. He said that there's supposed to be a coronation of some kind in Hemel. That's the capital of Darshiva, you know. My friend told me that they are going to crown some archduke from Mersina as Emperor of Meloria.
Meloria's already got an emperor, Velvet objected.
I think that may be part of the idea. My friend from Commerce is a fairly shrewd fellow, and he was speculating a bit after he told me what they are planning. Kalzakath's been in Tormurgos for years now, but he recently returned to Malzeth. Most of his army is still in the west, however, so he cannot put a great mass of troops into the field. My friends seem to think that Zandramas ordered this coronation in order to infuriate the Emperor to the point that he will do something rash. It is my guess that she hopes to lure him out of Malzeth so her forces can fall on him. If she succeeds in killing him, this Archduke from Mersina will actually be the Emperor.
What's the point of that? Silk asked him.
You have heard of Irvan, haven't you?
The disciple?
That's the one. He has been sitting for centuries in Mariaska, but what's been going on in this part of the world has finally lured him out. It's because of Zandramas, you see. She is a direct challenge to him. Anyway, he marched across Karanda, gathering up an enormous army. The Karans even believe he has demons aiding him. Well, that's nonsense, of course, but Karans will believe anything. That is why Zandramas, or her people, have to get control of the Imperial Throne. She needs to bring the Malorian army back from Tolmurgos to match Irvan's forces. Otherwise he will destroy everything she has worked for.
The suddenly talkative bureaucrat sighed deeply, and his head began to nod.
I think he will sleep now, Zadi murmured to Belgarath.
Oh, that's all right, the old man replied. I have got what I need.
Not quite yet, Polgara said crisply from her cook fire. There are some things that I need as well. She carefully stepped across the littered floor of the half-ruined house and lightly touched one hand to the dozing bureaucrat's face. His eyes opened, and he looked at her a bit blankly.
How much do you know about Zandramas? She asked him. I think I would like to hear the full story, if you know it. How did she gain so much power?
Oh, that's a long story, lady.
We have time.
The thin Melcine rubbed at his eyes and stifled a yawn.
Let me see, he said half to himself. Where did it all start?
He sighed.
I came here to Peldane about 20 years ago. I was young and very enthusiastic. It was my first post, and I wanted very much to make good. Peldane's not such a bad place, really. We had Grolems here, naturally, but they were a long way from Irvan and Malyaska, and they did not take their religion very seriously. Torek had been dormant for 500 years, and Irvan wasn't interested in what was going on out here in the hinterlands.
Over in Darshiva, though, things were different. There had been some kind of a schism in the temple in Himmel, the capital, and it ended up in a bloodbath.
He smiled faintly.
One of the few times Grolems have ever put their knives to good use, I suppose. The upshot of the affair was that a new archpriest gained control of the temple. A man named Naradus.
Yes, Polgara said. We have heard of him.
I have never actually seen him, but I'm told he has very strange eyes. Anyway, among his followers there was a young Grolem priestess named Zandramas. She must have been about 16 then, very beautiful, I've heard. Naradus reintroduced the old forms of worship, and the altar in the temple at Himmel ran with blood.
He shuddered.
It seems that the young priestess was the most enthusiastic participant in the Grolem rite of sacrifice, either out of an excess of fanaticism or innate cruelty, or because she knew that this was the best way to attract the eye of the new archpriest. There are rumors that she attracted his eye in other ways as well. She had unearthed a very obscure passage in the Book of Torek that seemed to say that the rite of sacrifice should be performed unclad. They say that Zandramas has a striking figure, and I guess the combination of blood and her nakedness completely inflamed Naradus. I have heard that things used to happen in the sanctum of the temple during the rite that cannot be described in the presence of ladies.
I think we can skip over that part, Nabros, Polgara told him primly, glancing at Eriond.
Anyhow,
Nabros continued,
all Grolems claim to be sorcerers, but from what I gather, the ones in Darshiva were not very skilled. Naradus could manage a few things, but most of his followers resorted to charlatanism, sleight of hand, and other forms of trickery, you understand. At any rate, not long after Naradus had consolidated his position, word reached us here that Torak had been killed. Naradus and his underlings went into absolute despair. But something rather profound seems to have happened to Zandramas. She walked out of the temple at Himmel in a kind of daze. My friend from the Bureau of Commerce was there at the time, and he saw her. He said that her eyes were glazed, and that she had an expression of inhuman ecstasy on her face. When she reached the edge of the city, she stripped off her clothes and ran naked into the forest. We all assumed that she had gone completely mad, and that we had seen the last of her. Once in a while, though, travelers would report having seen her in that wilderness near the border of Lycandia. Sometimes she would run away from them, another time she would stop them and speak to them in a language no one could understand. They listened, though, perhaps because she still had not managed to find any clothes. Then, one day, after a few years, she showed up at the gates of Himmel. She was wearing a black Grolem robe made of satin, and she seemed to be totally in control of herself. She went to the temple and sought out Naradus. The archpriest had given himself wholly over to the grossest kind of debauchery in his despair. But after he and Zandramas spoke together privately, he seems to have had a reconversion of some kind. Since that time, he has been the follower. He will do anything Zandramas tells him to do. Zandramas spent a short time in the temple. Then she began to move about in Darshiva. At first, she spoke only with Grolems, but in time she went out and talked with ordinary people as well. She always told them the same thing, that a new god of Angarak was coming. After a time, word of what she was doing got back to Malyaska, and Irvin sent some very powerful Grolems to Darshiva to stop her. I am not sure what happened to her out there in that wilderness, but whatever it was seems to have filled her with enormous power. When Irvan's Grolems tried to stop her from preaching, she simply obliterated them.
Obliterated? Belgoroth exclaimed in astonishment.
That is about the only word I can use. Some of them she consumed with fire. Others were blasted to bits by bolts of lightning that shot down out of a cloudless sky. Once she opened the earth, dropped 5 of them into a pit, and closed the earth on them again. Irvan began to take her very seriously at that point, I guess. He sent more and more Grolems to Dasheva, but she destroyed them all. The Dashevan Grolems who chose to follow her were given real powers, so they did not have to resort to trickery anymore.
And the ones who did not? Polgara asked.
None of them survived. I understand that a few of them tried deception, pretending to accept her message. But I guess she could see right through them, and took appropriate steps. It probably was not really necessary, though. She spoke as if inspired, and no one could resist her message. Before long, all of Dasheva, Grolems and secular people alike, groveled at her feet. She moved north from Dasheva into Rengel and Varsebo, preaching as she went and converting whole multitudes. The archpriest Naratus followed her blindly, and he was also enormously eloquent, and appears to have only slightly less power than she does. For some reason, she never came across the River Magan into Paldain, until recently.
All right, Polgara said. She converted Rengel and Vorsebo. Then what?
I really can't say, Nabros shrugged. About 3 years ago, both she and Naradas disappeared. I think they went off to the west someplace. But I don't know for sure. About the last thing she told the crowds before she left was that she was going to be the bride of this new god that she has been talking about. Then, a month ago, her forces came across the Magan and invaded Paldain. That's about all I know, really.
Polgara stepped back. Thank you, Nabros. Why don't you see if you can get some sleep now? I will save some breakfast for you. He sighed, and his eyelids began to droop.
Thank you, lady,
he said drowsily, and a moment later he was fast asleep. Polgara gently covered him with a blanket. Belgarath motioned to them, and they all went back over to the fire again. It is all beginning to fit together now, isn't it? When Torek died, the Dark Spirit took over Zandramos and made her the Child of Dark. That's what that business in the wilderness was all about. Zenedra had been muttering to herself under her breath. Her eyes were dangerous and her face angry.
You had better do something about this old man,
she said threateningly to Belgarath. About what? He looked a little baffled.
You heard what that man said. He told us that Zandramos plans to be the bride of this new god.
Yes, he said mildly. I heard him.
You're not going to let something like that happen, are you?
I had not planned to, no. What has got you so upset, Zenedra? Her eyes flashed.
I will not have Zandramos for a daughter-in-law,
she declared hotly.
No matter what happens.
He stared at her for a moment. Then he began to laugh. Chapter 11 By mid-afternoon, the wan dish of the sun had begun to burn through the pervading mist, and Belden returned.
The fog's completely cleared away about a league west of here, he told them.
Are there any signs of movement out there? Belgarath asked.
Some, Belden replied. A few detachments of troops that are all headed north. Otherwise, it's as empty as a merchant's soul. Oh, sorry, Keldar. It's just an old expression.
That's all right, Belden, Silk forgave him grandly. These little slips of the tongue are common in the very elderly.
Belden gave him a hard look and then continued. The villages up ahead all seem to be deserted, mostly in ruins. I would say that the villagers have fled.
He glanced at the sleeping Melusine.
Who's your guest?
He is with the Bureau of Roads, Belgarath replied.
Silk found him hiding in a cellar.
Is he really all that sleepy?
Tsadi gave him something to calm his nerves.
Well, I'd say it worked pretty good. He looks very calm.
Would you like something to eat, Uncle?
Polgara asked.
Well, thanks all the same, Paul, but I had a fat rabbit an hour or so ago.
He looked back at Belgarath.
I think we'll still want to travel at night. You don't have whole regiments out there, but there are enough to give us trouble if they happen to surprise us.
Any idea of whose troops they are?
I didn't see any guardsmen, nor Karans. I would guess they belong to Zandramos or to the King of Peldane. Whoever they are, they're going north toward that battle that's about to begin.
All right. We will travel at night, then. At least until we get past the soldiers. They moved along at a fair rate of speed that night. They had passed the woods, and the watchfires of the soldiers encamped on the plain made them easy to avoid. Then, just before dawn, Belgarath and Geryon stopped atop a low hill and looked down at a camp that seemed quite a bit larger than those they had passed earlier.
About a battalion, Grandfather, Geryon surmised. I think we've got a problem here. The country around here is awfully flat. This is the only hill we have seen for miles, and there isn't very much cover. No matter how we try to hide, their scouts are going to see us. It might be safer if we turned around and went back a ways.
Belgarath laid back his ears in irritation. Oh, let's go back and warn the others, he growled. He rose to his feet and led Geryon back the way they had come.
There is no point in taking chances, Father,
Polgara said, after she had drifted in on silent wings.
The country was more broken a few miles back. We can go back there and find shelter.
Were the cooks making breakfast?
Tsadi asked.
Yes, Geryon replied. I could smell it. Some kind of porridge and bacon.
They're not likely to move or send out scouts until after they eat, are they?
No, Geryon told him. Troops get very surly if you make them start marching before you feed them.
And were the sentries all wearing the standard military cloak? The ones that look more or less like these?
He plucked at the front of his traveler's cloak.
The ones I saw were, Geryon said.
Why don't we pay them a visit, Prince Skeldar? The eunuch suggested.
What have you got in mind? Silk asked suspiciously.
Porridge is so bland, don't you think? I have a number of things in my case that can spice it up just a bit. We can walk through the encampment like a pair of sentries who have just been relieved and go directly to the cook fires for a bit of breakfast. I shouldn't have much trouble seasoning the kettles with certain condiments.
Silk grinned at him. No poison, Belgarath said firmly.
I had not considered poison, ancient one, Tsadi protested mildly. Not out of any sense of morality, mind you. It's just that soldiers tend to grow suspicious when their messmates turn black in the face and topple over. I have something much more pleasant in mind. The soldiers will be deliriously happy for a short while, and then they'll fall asleep.
For how long? Silk asked.
Several days,
Tsadi shrugged.
A week, at the very most,
Silk whistled. Is it dangerous at all?
Only if one has a weak heart. I've used it on myself on occasion, when I was particularly tired. Shall we go, then?
Teaming those two together may have been a moral blunder, Belgarath mused, as the two rogues walked off in the darkness toward the twinkling watchfires. It was about an hour later when the little Drasnian and the eunuch returned.
It's safe now,
Zadi reported. We can go on through their camp. There is a low range of hills, a league or so farther on, where we can take shelter until night.
Any trouble at all?
Velvet asked. Not a bit, Silk smirked. Zod is very good at that sort of thing. Practice, my dear Keldar. I have poisoned a fair number of people in my time. He grinned mirthlessly. Once, I gave a banquet for a group of my enemies. Not a single one of them saw me season the soup, of course. And the Essens are very observant when it comes to that sort of thing.
Didn't they get suspicious when you did not eat any soup?
Velvet asked curiously. Oh, but I did, Lysel. I'd spent an entire week dosing myself with the antidote, he shuddered. Vile tasting stuff, as I recall. The poison itself was quite tasty. A number of my guests even complimented me on the soup before they left. He sighed. Ah, those were the good old days, he mourned. I think we can reminisce later on, Belgarath said. Let's see if we can reach those hills before the sun gets much higher. The soldiers' encampment was silent, except for an occasional snore. The troops were all smiling happily as they slept. The following night was cloudy, and the air smelled strongly of incipient rain. Geryon and Belgarath had no trouble finding the encampments of the soldiers in their path, and a few overheard snatches of conversation revealed the fact that these troops were members of the Royal Army of Peldane, and further, that they were approaching the impending battle with a great deal of reluctance. About morning, Geryon and his grandfather trotted back to rejoin the others with Polgara ghosting just above them on silent wings.
A sound is still a sound, Durnik was saying stubbornly to Belden. The two were riding side by side. But if there's nobody to hear it, how can we call it a sound? Belden argued.
Belgarath shook himself into his own form.
The noise in the woods again, Belden, he said in a tone of profound disgust. The hunchback shrugged.
Well, you've got to start somewhere.
Can't you think of anything new? After we argued the question for 1,000 years, I thought you might have gotten tired of it.
What's this? Polgara asked, walking through the tall grass to join them in the shadowless light of dawn.
Belden and Durnik are discussing a very tired old philosophical question, Belgarath snorted. If there is a noise in the woods, and there's nobody around to hear it, is it really a noise?
Well, of course it is, she replied calmly.
Well, how did you reach that conclusion? Belden demanded.
Because there is no such thing as an empty place, Uncle. There are always creatures around, wild animals, mice, insects, birds, and they can all hear.
Oh, but what if they weren't? What if the woods are truly empty?
Why waste your time talking about an impossibility?
He stared at her in frustration.
Not only that,
Tenedra added, just a bit smugly.
You're talking about woods, so there are trees there. Trees can hear too, you know.
He glared at her.
Why are you all taking sides against me?
Because you are wrong, Uncle,
Polgara smiled.
Wrong, Polgara? He spluttered. Me?
It happens to everybody once in a while. Why don't we all have some breakfast?
The sun rose while they were eating, and Belgarath looked up, squinting into the morning rays.
We haven't seen any soldiers since midnight. And all we have seen so far are troops of the army of Peldane. They're not really anything to worry about. So I think it's safe to ride on a little farther this morning.
He looked at Silk.
How far is it to the border of Darshiva?
Not really all that far, but we haven't been making very good time.
It's spring, so the nights are getting shorter, and we lose time when we have to circle around these troops. He frowned. We might have a bit of a problem at the border, though. We're going to have to cross the River Magan, and if everyone has fled the area, we could have some trouble finding a boat.
Is the Magan really as big as they say? Zadi asked.
It's the biggest river in the world. It runs for 1,000 leagues and more, and it is so wide that you cannot see the far shore.
Durnick rose to his feet. I want to check over the horses before we go any farther. We've been riding them in the dark. That's always a little dangerous, but I don't want any of them pulling up lame.
Eriond and Toth also rose, and the three of them went through the tall grass to the place where the horses were picketed.
I'll go on ahead, Belden said. Even if the troops are Peldanes, we still don't need any surprises.
He changed form and flew off toward the west, spiraling up into the cloudless morning sky. Geryon stretched his legs out in front of him and leaned back on his elbows.
You must be tired,
Zinedra said, sitting beside him and touching his face tenderly.
Oh, wolves don't really get that tired, he told her. I get the feeling that I could run for a week if I really had to.
Well, you don't have to, so don't even consider it.
Yes, dear.
Zadi had risen to his feet with his red leather case in his hands.
As long as we are stopped, I think I'll find something to feed Zith.
A small frown touched his brow.
You know, Lysel, he said to Velvet, I think you were right back in Zamad. She definitely looks as if she's gained a few ounces.
Put her on a diet,
the blonde girl suggested.
I'm not sure about that, he smiled. It's very hard to explain to a snake why you are starving her, and I would not want her to get cross with me.
They rode out not long afterward, following Toth's gestured directions.
He says that we can probably find a village south of the big town on the river, Durnick told them.
Fera, Silk supplied.
Oh, I suppose so. I haven't looked at a map for a while. Anyway, he says that there are quite a few villages on this side where we might be able to hire a boat to get us across to Darsheva.
That's assuming that they aren't all deserted, Silk added.
Durnick shrugged. We'll never know till we get there.
It was a warm morning, and they rode across the rolling grasslands of southern Peldane under cloudless skies. About mid-morning, Eriond rode forward and fell in beside Geryon.
Do you think Pulgara would mind if you and I took a little gallop? Maybe to that hill over there?
He pointed at a large knoll off to the north.
Oh, she probably would, Geryon said. Unless we can come up with a good reason. You don't think she'd accept the idea that Horst and Gretchen need to run once in a while? Eriond, you've known her for a long time. Do you really think she'd listen if we tried to tell her that?
Eriond sighed.
No, I suppose not.
Geryon squinted at the hilltop.
We really ought to keep an eye out to the north, though, he said thoughtfully. That's where the trouble's going to break out. We sort of need to know what's happening up there, don't we? That hilltop would be a perfect place to have a look.
Well, that's very true, Belgarion.
It's not as if we'd actually be lying to her.
I wouldn't dream of lying to her.
Of course not. Neither would I.
The two young men grinned at each other. I'll tell Belgarath where we're going, Geryon said.
We'll let him explain it to her.
He's the perfect one to do it,
Eriond agreed. Geryon dropped back and touched his half-dozing grandfather's shoulder.
Eriond and I are going to ride over to that hill, he said. I want to see if there are any signs that the fighting started yet.
What? Oh, good idea. Belgarath yawned and closed his eyes again.
Geryon motioned to Eriond,
and the two of them trotted off into the tall grass at the side of the trail.
Garion, Volgara called. Where are you going?
Grandfather can explain it, Aunt Paul, he shouted back. We'll catch up again in just a bit, he looked at Eriond.
Now, let's get out of earshot in a hurry.
They went north, first at a gallop, and then at a dead run with the grass whipping at their horses' legs. The chestnut and the gray matched stride for stride, plunging along with their heads thrust far forward and their hooves pounding on the thick turf. Garion leaned forward in his saddle, surrendering to the flow and surge of Kretchen's muscles. Both he and Eriond were laughing with delight when they reined in on the hilltop.
That was good, Garion said, swinging down from his saddle.
We don't get the chance to do that very often anymore, do we?
Not often enough,
Eriond agreed, also dismounting.
You managed to arrange it very diplomatically, Belgarion.
Well, of course. Diplomacy is what kings do best.
Do you think we fooled her?
Us? Garion laughed. Fool, Aunt Paul? Be serious, Eriond.
I suppose you're right.
Eriond made a wry face.
She'll probably scold us, won't she?
Inevitably. But the ride was worth a scolding, wasn't it?
Eriond smiled. Then he looked around, and his smile faded.
Belgarion,
he said sadly, pointing to the north. Garion looked. Tall columns of black smoke rose along the horizon.
It looks as if it started, he said bleakly. Yes,
Eriond sighed.
Why do they have to do that?
Garion crossed his arms on Kretchen's saddle and leaned his chin pensively on them.
Pride, I suppose, he replied. And the hunger for power. Revenge, too, sometimes, I guess. Once in Arendia, Lulduran said that very often it's because people just don't know how to stop it. Once it started. But it's also senseless. Of course it is. Erends aren't the only stupid people on the earth. Anytime you have two people who both want the same thing badly enough, you're going to have a fight. If the two people have enough followers, they call it a war. If a couple of ordinary men have that kind of disagreement, there might be a broken nose and some missing teeth, but when you start getting armies involved, people get killed. Are you and Zakath going to have a war, then?
It was a troubling question, and Garion wasn't sure he knew the answer.
I don't really know, he admitted. He wants to rule the world, Eriond pointed out. And you don't want him to. Isn't that the sort of thing that starts a war?
Well, it's awfully hard to say, Garion replied sadly.
Maybe if we hadn't left Malzeth when we did, I might have been able to bring him around. But we had to leave, so I lost the chance, he sighed. I think it's finally going to be up to him. Maybe he has changed enough so that he will abandon the whole idea. But then again, maybe he hasn't. You can never tell with a man like Zakath. I hope he's given up the notion. I don't want a war. Not with anybody. But I'm not going to bow to him either. The world was not meant to be ruled by one man, and certainly not by somebody like Zakath. But you like him, don't you? Yes, I do. I wish I could have met him before Tau-Urgas ruined his life.
He paused, and his face grew set.
No. There's a man I'd rather cheerfully have gone to war with. He contaminated the whole world just by living in it. But it wasn't really his fault. He was insane, and that excuses him. You are a very forgiving young man, Eriond. Well, isn't it easier to forgive than to hate? Until we learn how to forgive, that sort of thing is going to keep on happening.
He pointed at the tall pillars of smoke, rising to the north.
Hate is a sterile thing, Belgarion. I know, Geryon sighed. I hated Torak. But in the end, I guess I forgave him. More out of pity than anything else. I still had to kill him, though. What do you think the world would be like if people did not kill each other anymore? Nicer, probably. Why don't we fix it that way, then?
You and I, Geryon laughed, all by ourselves?
Why not? Because it's impossible, Eriand. I thought you and Belgarath had settled the issue of impossible a long time ago.
Geryon laughed again.
Yes, I suppose we did. All right, let's drop impossible. Would you accept extremely difficult instead? Nothing that's really worthwhile should be easy, Belgarion. If it's easy, we don't value it. But I'm certain we'll be able to find an answer.
He said it with such shining confidence in his face that for a moment, Geryon actually believed that the wild notion might indeed be feasible. Then he looked out at the ugly columns of smoke again, and the hope died.
I suppose we should go back and let the others know what's happening out there.
It was about noon when Belden returned.
There's another detachment of troops about a mile ahead, he told Belgarath. A dozen or so.
Are they going toward that battle to the north?
No, I'd say this particular group is running away from it. They look as if they were fairly well mauled recently.
Could you tell which side they are on?
Well, that doesn't really matter, Belgarath. A man gives up his allegiances when he deserts.
Sometimes. You are so clever, you make me sick.
Why don't you have Paul mix you up something to cure it?
How long has that been going on?
Velvet asked Bulgara.
And which was that, dear? That constant wrangling between those two.
Bulgara closed her eyes and sighed.
You wouldn't believe it, Lyselle. Sometimes I think it started at about the beginning of time.
The soldiers they encountered were wary, even frightened. They stood their ground, however, with their hands on their weapons. Silk made a quick motion to Geryon, and the two of them rode forward at an unthreatening walk.
Good day, gentlemen, Silk greeted them conversationally.
What in the world is happening around here?
You mean you haven't had?
A wiry fellow with a bloody bandage around his head asked.
I haven't found anybody to tell me, Silk replied.
What happened to all of the people who used to live in this part of Paldane? We haven't seen a soul in the last 4 days.
They all fled, the bandaged man told him. The ones who were still alive did, at any rate.
What were they fleeing from?
Xanthromos, the fellow replied with a shudder. Her army marched into Paldane about a month ago. We tried to stop them, but they had Grolems with them. And ordinary troops can't do much against Grolems.
Oh, that's the truth, certainly. What's all that smoke up to the north?
There's a battle going on.
The soldier sat down on the ground and began to unwind the blood-stained bandage from around his head.
It's not like any battle I've ever seen, another soldier supplied.
His left arm was in a sling, and he looked as if he had just spent several days lying in the mud.
I've been in a few wars, but nothing like this. When you're a soldier, you take your chances. Swords and arrows and spears and the like, you know. But when they start throwing horrors at me, it begins to feel it's time to find another line of work.
Horrors? Silk asked him.
He's got demons with him, friend. Both sides of him has. Monstrous big demons, with snaky arms and fangs and claws and such like.
Oh, but you're not serious.
I've seen him. With my own eyes. You ever seen a man get Ed alive. Makes your hair stand on end, it does.
I don't quite follow this, Silk confessed. Who is involved in this battle? I mean, ordinary armies don't keep tame demons with them to help with the fighting.
That's the honest truth, the muddy man agreed. An ordinary soldier's like to leave the service if they expect him to march alongside something that looks at him as if he was something to eat. I never did get the straight of it, though.
He looked at the man with the wounded head.
Did you ever find out who was fighting, Corporal?
The corporal was wrapping a clean bandage around his head.
The captain told us before and got killed, he said.
Maybe you had better start at the beginning, Silk said. I am a little confused about this.
Like I told you, the corporal said. About a month ago, the Darshivans and their Grolems invaded Preldane. Me and my men are in the Royal Army of Preldane, so we tried to hold them back. We slowed them some on the east bank of the Megan, but then the Grolems come at us. We had to retreat. Then we heard that there was another army coming down out in the north. Terrans and soldiers in armor and more Grolems. We figured that we was really in for it at that point. But as it turns out, this new army isn't connected with the Darshivans. Seems it's working for some odd Grolem way off in the west. Well, this Grolem, he sets up along the coast and don't come inland at all. It's like he's waiting for something. We had our hands full with the Darshivans, so we wasn't too interested in what it was he was waiting for. We was doing a lot of what our officers called maneuvering, which is officer talk for running away.
I take it that the Grolem finally decided to come inland after all, Silk observed.
He sure did, friend. He surely did. It was just a few days ago when he struck inland just as straight as a tight string. Either he knew exactly where he was going or he was following something. I don't know exactly which. Anyway, the Darshivans, they stopped chasing us and rushed in to try and block his way. That's when he called in the demons Verk he was talking about. At first the demons charged right through the Darshivans, but then their Grolems, or maybe it was Sandra Moss herself, they conjured up their demons. That's when the big fight commenced. The demons, they went at each other for all they was worth, and they trampled over anybody unlucky enough to get in the way. There we was, caught right in the middle of it and all, and getting trampled on by first one set of demons, then the other. That's when me and Verk and these others put our heads together and decided to find out what the weather's like in Gandahar.
It's hot there this time of year, Silk told him.
Not near as hot as it is north of here, friend. You ever see a demon breathe fire? I seen one of them armored soldiers get roasted alive right inside his chainmail. Then the demon picked him out of his armor piece by piece and ate him while he was still smoking.
The corporal knotted the ends of his fresh bandage.
Well, that ought to hold it, he said, rising to his feet again.
He looked up into the noon sky, squinting slightly.
We can make some miles before the sun goes down, Verk, he said to his muddy friend. Get the men ready to march. If that battle starts to spread out, we could get caught in the middle of it again, and none of us wants that.
We'll do it, Corporal, Verk replied.
The corporal looked at Silk again, his eyes narrowed appraisingly.
You and your friends are welcome to come along. A few men on horseback might be an help in case we run into trouble.
Oh, thanks all the same, Corporal, Silk declined. But I think we'll ride over to the Magan and see if we can find a boat. We could be at the mouth of the river in a week or so.
Well, I'll advise riding hard, then, my friend. Demons can run awful fast when they're hungry.
Silk nodded. Good luck in Gandahar, Corporal.
I think I'll stop being a corporal, the fellow said ruefully. Well, the pay wasn't bad, but the work's getting dangerouser and dangerouser. All the pay in the world won't do a man much good if he takes up residence inside a demon.
He turned to his friend.
Let's move out, Verk, he ordered.
Silk wheeled his horse and rode back to where the others were waiting, Geryon close behind him. It's more or less what we thought, the little man reported, dismounting. The battle up north is between Urvan and Sandramos, and both sides have demons now.
She went that far?
Polgara asked incredulously. Oh, she didn't really have that much choice, Balgara, Silk told her. Nahaz was leading his hordes of demons into the ranks of her troops, and her army was being decimated. She had to do something to stop him. Being captured by a demon is no joke, not even for the Child of Dark.
All right, Durnick said soberly. What do we do now?
The corporal in charge of those troops made an interesting suggestion, Silk told him.
Oh? What was that?
He recommended that we get out of Peldain as fast as we possibly can.
The corporals usually have good sense, Durnick noted. Why don't we follow his advice?
Oh, I was hoping someone would say that, Silk agreed.
Chapter 12 Vella was feeling melancholy. It was an unusual emotion for her, but she found she rather liked it. There was much to be said for sweet, languorous sadness. She went with quiet dignity through the stately marble-clad corridors of the palace in Bokdor, and everyone gave way to her pensive expression. She chose not to consider the fact that her daggers may have played a certain part in this universal respect. In point of fact, Vella had not drawn a dagger on anyone for almost a week now, the last having been a slightly over-familiar serving man who had mistaken her bluff camaraderie for an offer of a more intimate friendship. But she had not hurt him very much, and he had forgiven her almost before the bleeding had stopped. Her destination that early morning was the sitting room of the Queen of Thrasnia. In many ways, Queen Porin baffled Vella. She was petite and imperturbable. She carried no daggers, and seldom raised her voice. But all of Thrasnia and the other Elorn kingdoms held her in universal regard. Vella herself, not knowing exactly why, had acceded to the tiny queen's suggestion that she should customarily garb herself in gowns of lavender satin. A gown is a cumbersome thing that tangles up one's legs and confines one's bosom. Always before, Vella had preferred black leather trousers, boots, and a leather vest. The garb was comfortable and utilitarian. It was sturdy, and yet it provided opportunities for Vella to display her attributes to those whom she wished to impress. Then, on special occasions, she had customarily donned an easily discardable wool dress and a fine diaphanous undergown of rose-colored Malorian silk that clung to her as she danced. Satin, on the other hand, rustled disturbingly, but felt good against her skin, and it made Vella uncomfortably aware of the fact that there was more to being a woman than a couple of pair of daggers and a willingness to use them. She tapped lightly on Porin's door.
Yes,
Porin's voice came to her. Did the woman never sleep?
It's me, Porin, Vella. Come in, child.
Vella set her teeth. She was not, after all, a child. She had been abroad in the world since her 12th birthday. She had been sold and bought a half dozen times, and she had been married for a brief, deliriously happy year to a lean Nedrak trapper named Tek, whom she had loved to distraction. Porin, however, seemed to prefer to look upon her as some half-gentled colt in sore need of training. In spite of herself, that thought softened Vella's resentment. The little blonde queen of Thrasnia had, in some strange way, become the mother she had never known, and thoughts of daggers and of being bought and sold slid away under the influence of that wise, gentle voice.
"Good morning, Vella,"
Porin said as the Nadrak girl entered her room.
"Would you like some tea?"
Although the queen always wore black in public, her dressing gown that morning was of the palest rose, and she looked somehow very vulnerable in that soft color.
"Hello, Porin,"
Vella said.
"No tea, thanks."
She flung herself into a chair beside the blonde queen's divan.
"Don't flop, Vella,"
Porin told her.
"Ladies, don't flop." "I'm not a lady." "Not yet, perhaps, but I'm working on it." Why are you wasting your time on me, Porin?
Nothing worthwhile is ever a waste of time.
Me? Worthwhile?
More than you could possibly know. You are early this morning. Is something troubling you?
I haven't been able to sleep. I've been having the strangest dreams lately.
Don't let dreams bother you, child. Dreams are sometimes the past, sometimes the future, but mostly they are only that. Dreams.
Please don't call me child, Porin,
Vella objected.
I think if we got right down to it, I'm almost as old as you are.
In years, perhaps, but years are not the only way to measure time.
There was a discreet rap at the door.
Yes,
Porin replied.
It's me, Your Majesty,
a familiar voice said.
Come in, Margrave Kenden,
the Queen said. Javelin had not changed since Vella had last seen him. He was still bone-thin and aristocratic, and had a sardonically amused twist to his lips. He wore, as was his custom, a pearl-gray doublet and tight-fitting black hose. His skinny shanks were not shown to any particular advantage by the latter. He bowed rather extravagantly.
Your Majesty,
he greeted the Queen.
And my Lady Vella.
Don't be insulting, Javelin,
Vella retorted.
I don't have a title, so don't my lady me.
Haven't you told her yet?
Javelin mildly asked the Queen.
I am saving it for her birthday.
What is this?
Vella demanded.
Be patient, dear,
Porin told her.
You will find out about your title all in due time.
I don't need a Drasnian title.
Everybody needs a title, dear, even if it is only ma'am.
Has she always been like this?
Vella bluntly asked the chief of Drasnian intelligence.
She was a little more ingenuous when she still had her baby teeth,
Javelin replied urbanely.
But she got to be more fun when she developed her fangs.
Be nice, Kenden,
Porin told him.
How was Rakurga?
Ugly. But then, most Murgo cities are.
And how is King Urgot?
Newly married, Your Majesty, and a little distracted by the novelty of it.
Porin made a face.
I didn't send a gift,
she fretted.
I took the liberty of attending to that, Your Majesty,
Javelin said.
A rather nice silver service I picked up in Tolhanath. At a bargain price, of course. I have this limited budget, you understand.
She gave him a long, unfriendly look.
I left the bill with your chamberlain,
he added, with not even the faintest trace of embarrassment.
How are the negotiations going?
Surprisingly well, my queen. The king of the Murgos seems not to have yet succumbed to the hereditary disorder of the House of Urga. He is very shrewd, actually.
I somehow thought he might be,
Porin replied, just a bit smugly.
You are keeping secrets, Porin,
Javelin accused.
Yes, women do that from time to time. Are the Malorian agents in the Drojum keeping abreast of things?
Oh, yes, Javelin smiled. Sometimes we have to be a little bit obvious in order to make sure that they're getting the point. But they are more or less fully aware of the progress of the negotiations. We seem to be making them a bit apprehensive.
You made good time on your return voyage.
Javelin shuddered slightly.
King Aneg put a ship at our disposal. Her captain is that pirate, Greldik. I made the mistake of telling him that I was in a hurry. The passage through the Boar was ghastly.
There was another polite knock at the door.
Yes,
Porin answered. A servant opened the door.
The Nadrak Yablek is here again, Your Majesty,
he reported.
Oh, show him in, please.
Yablek had a tight look on his face that Vella recognized all too well. Her owner was, in many respects, a transparent man. He pulled off his shabby fur cap.
Good morning, Porin,
he said, without ceremony, tossing the cap into a corner.
Have you got anything to drink? I've been in the saddle for 5 days, and I'm perishing of thirst.
Over there,
Porin pointed at a sideboard near the window. Yarblick grunted, crossed the room, and filled a large goblet from a crystal decanter. He took a long drink.
Javelin, he said then. Have you got any people in Yarnadrak?
A few, Javelin admitted cautiously.
You'd better have them keep an eye on Drosta. He's up to something.
He's always up to something.
That's no lie. But this might be a little more serious. He has reopened the lines of communication with Marzev. He and Zakath have not been on speaking terms since he changed sides at Turl Mardu. But now they are talking again. I don't like the smell of it.
Are you sure? None of my people have reported it.
They are probably in the palace then. Drosta doesn't conduct serious business there. Have them go to a riverside tavern in the thieves' quarter. It's called the One-Eyed Dog. Drosta goes there to amuse himself. The emissary from Malzeth's been meeting with him in an upstairs room there. That's when Drosta can drag himself away from the girls.
I'll put some people on it right away. Could you get any idea at all of what they are discussing?
Yarblick shook his head and dropped wearily into a chair.
Drosta has ordered his guards to keep me out of the place.
He looked at Vella.
You're looking a little pecky this morning, he observed. Did you drink too much last night?
I almost never get drunk anymore, she told him.
I knew it was a mistake to leave you here in Bokhtar, he said glumly. Porin is a corrupting influence. Did you get over your irritation with me yet?
I suppose so. It's not really your fault that you're stupid.
Thanks. He looked her up and down appraisingly. I like the dress. Makes you look more like a woman for a change.
Did you ever have any doubts, Yarblick?
She asked him archly. Addis, the chief eunuch in the palace of Eternal Salmisra, received the summons early that morning, and he approached the throne room with fear and trembling. The queen had been in a peculiar mood of late, and Addis painfully remembered the fate of his predecessor. He entered the dimly lit throne room and prostrated himself before the dais.
The chief eunuch approaches the throne, the adoring chorus intoned in unison.
Even though he himself had been until recently a member of that chorus, Addis found their mouthing of the obvious irritating. The queen dozed on her divan, her mottled coils moving restlessly with the dry hiss of scales rubbing against each other. She opened her soulless serpent's eyes and looked at him, her forked tongue flickering.
Well?
She said peevishly, in the dusty whisper that always chilled his blood.
You summoned me, Divine Salmisra?
He faltered.
I'm aware of that, you idiot. Do not irritate me, Addis. I'm on the verge of going into molt, and that always makes me short-tempered. I asked you to find out what the Elorns are up to. I'm waiting for your report.
I haven't been able to find out very much, my queen.
That is not the answer. I wanted to hear, Addis,
she told him dangerously.
Is it possible that the duties of your office are beyond your capabilities?
Addis began to tremble violently.
I've sent for Droblek, your majesty, but Thrasnian Port Authority here in Stithi's store. I thought he might be able to shed some light on this situation.
Perhaps so.
Her tone was distant, and she gazed at her reflection in the mirror.
Summon the Tolnedrin ambassador as well. whatever the Alorns are doing in Tolmurkos also involves Varana.
Forgive me, Divine Salmisra, Addis said, feeling a trifle confused. But why should the activities of the Alorns and Tolnedrans concern us?
She swung her head about slowly, her sinuous neck weaving in the air.
Are you a total incompetent, Addis?
She asked him.
We may not like it, but Nyssa is part of the world, and we must always know what our neighbors are doing and why.
She paused, her tongue nervously tasting the air.
There is a game of some kind afoot, and I want to find out exactly what it is before I decide whether or not to become involved in it.
She paused again.